You're on the Front Porch. Support for the Front Porch comes from the Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather, keeping you in the know while you're on the go. This week, we're talking about what actually works in fighting opioid addiction with Lois Vance, Cabin Creek Health System's care coordinator working with people in recovery. I'm Rick Wilson with the American Friends Service Committee, filling in for Scott Finn, Grand Poobah of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I understand that Scott is in seclusion after failing to make the Winter Olympics team. I just want to say, Scott, wherever you are, figure skating isn't everything. Come home. Your family needs you. So we have Lois Vance here today, who is like very much hands-on with the people who are receiving treatment. My impression, you're kind of like a den mother, right? I mean, people talk to you about their kids, about their work, about every little thing.
They do. They call me. Sometimes they'll call me at 10 o'clock at night and say, I've made it through the day. And sometimes they'll call me and say, I'm about to go buy heroin. What do I do? Or they'll call me and say, I've bought groceries for the first time, you know, or I was able to buy Christmas presents for the first time. And they either, they hate me going in, but they love me after a while because they realize that I'm there for them.
I think some people don't really realize how intensive the program is for people entering recovery, what's involved in it. And also, you know, sometimes I think people feel hopeless. There's actually, I've talked to several of your patients, there really are success story. So could you start talking us through that, how it works?
Sure. And when patients call in and talk about getting into the program, they have to have a medical exam and a psychological exam. And then the first week they come 2 days in a row. They come to us in withdrawal, which means they're very, very sick. And then we give them medication. And then they come back the second day and we check on them to make sure they're okay. And then we give them a prescription for that for the rest of the week. Then they come to us once a week, every week, for a period of 90 days. Once they're in recovery for 90 days, they can move to a biweekly program. But in those weeks, they're required to do 4 hours of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous meetings on their own time.
Okay.
They are subject to random urine drug screens. We can call them, and within 24 hours, they have to respond to us. They have to bring in their medication that they have left over and the empty wrappers that they have taken their medication from. Okay. We track those with help of our pharmacy to make sure that what we're getting back is what we're giving out. It's a very rigorous program.
So it's pretty intensive.
It is very intense.
All the way around. Can you talk about, I mean, it's medically assisted treatment, so the medicine in question is Suboxone.
I'm curious
what that is and
that's
how it works and explain
Suboxone
that a little bit.
Suboxone is a combination medication. It's buprenorphine. And it also has naloxone in it, which is Narcan. So the medication prevents the patient from using any opioid. I mean, they can use an opioid, but it makes them very sick. It puts them into immediate withdrawal. If they try, either the opioid has no effect, and if they do enough, it will make them extremely ill.
And that has to be continued, or how does that work?
It does have to be continued. Once we get their dose to a therapeutic level and get their dose corrected, they take the same dose every day. And they are recommended to take that dose at the same time every day. There are tests that we do to make sure that they're taking their medicine the way that it's recommended that they take it. We run tests to make sure that they're taking it the way they're supposed to. We check on them often. They come in often. We call them often. So it is very rigorous.
Is there an endpoint for Suboxone, or is that something people just need to stay on, or how does that work?
The goal is to get people off this medication.
Right.
But we don't start talking to the patient about that for 12 to 18 months.
Okay.
And then that's a decision that the doctor and the therapist and the patient all make together.
Okay.
When the patient feels it's time to start the reducing program, they talk to the doctor, talk to the therapist, and then that's a very, very slow process to get a patient from that, because the cravings may come back, the wish to use may come back.
Right.
It's a very, very slow process. Some folks are successful in weaning off the medicine, and some folks are not.
It's probably like quitting smoking times 12, right?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it's like.
Okay.
Or being on a the diabetic diet and wanting a donut.
Right.
You know, it's got the, you got that craving all the time, but yeah, it's about the same thing.
So could you tell some stories? I know you can't reveal names, but.
Right. I won't talk about anybody in particular, but just recently, very recently, we had a new patient come in. The one thing I do before we start treatment is take a drug use history. I'm waiting to get to the point where I'm not astounded by what people have gone through. Mm. But this particular person started using Vicodin when he was 6 years old. His father was a drug dealer, and he started smoking pot when he was eight. Wow. And he says that people look at him constantly and say, why don't you just stop doing that? Why don't you just stop using that? And he said, how can I do that? I've been doing this my entire life. How can I just stop without help? He's overdosed and been Narcan on several occasions. Mm. And he knows. And he told me, he said, I know I'm still here for a purpose, and I have got to find out what that is. And he's very grateful to be in the program, very thankful. And we have another patient who has been using heroin since he was nine. Mm. And we have patients who didn't start using until they were 60. It's just a whole gamut of things.
So you have to work on your poker face sometimes.
I do. And sometimes I'm not real successful with a poker face. And that's okay. You know, I cry with them or laugh with them or whatever it takes. But, you know, we have young ladies who were sexually abused at 5 years old and have spent their whole life trying to mask that pain. And eventually they get to the point where it's not about being high. It's not about getting the drug to be high. They're just trying not to be sick. Right. And that's what people don't understand about addiction.
Thing about addiction.
They think,
right,
that these folks are out trying to stay high all the time, and that's not the case. At a certain point, they no longer are trying to get high. They're just trying not to be sick all the time.
Yeah.
And that's when we get, that's usually when we can get them. That's when treatment is successful, when they've reached that.
So I'm a Tolkien geek, you know, Lord of the Rings. And I think like Gollum, the character in there, is a good example of addiction. I mean, he has this thing that he's addicted to and it just destroys him with the thought of losing. And that's like addiction is a cheating promise, right? You might start out thinking you feel good and then it's about just not feeling bad, right?
Right. And I've probably talked to 250, 300 patients over there, and never have I asked somebody if they wanted to be in recovery and they told me no.
Right.
Never. One young lady said, no, I don't want to do that. But she's a brand new addict. She has no idea what her life's about to become. I've had men just break down and say, yes, I want to, but I don't know how. Mm. The stories are just unbelievable. The things that people survive. But when you see this happen, when you get somebody into the program and you start counseling them and letting them know that people care about them, and you see that recovery does happen, it's pretty miraculous, because you see somebody walk in and you think, how are they here? How did they get here? How did they survive long enough to be here? And within weeks, they look different, they walk different, they get jobs, they're managing restaurants, they get their families back together. I've had mothers call me and thank me because mothers of patients, because they like their children again. They always love their children, but they thought they were losing their children, and they say, thank you, I like my child again.
Well, speaking of, you're talking about children and things people go through, I can't help thinking of the ACEs study, adverse childhood experiences, which, for one thing, I think probably a lot of people with addiction are coming out of some of those, and then I think there's a whole generation of kids coming up today, just think of all the, you know, who are dealing with this as secondary casualties, I guess, of the opioid wave. Is there anything, can you want to say anything about that?
It's like these people that, you know, they've been using since they were 6 and 9 years old. Their parents taught them how to do that.
Yeah.
And so their parents were addicts, and then the children are addicts, and now we're working on another generation. The fellow that had been using heroin since he was nine has children. Now the other person does not. But this is nearly the third generation that we're seeing that they don't understand when they're children that not everyone lives that way. Mm-hmm. This is the third generation, beginning on the third generation. I didn't know this until recently, that the school system has a program in place that any time a first responder goes to a child's house, a text message goes to that school.
Oh, the handle with care, right?
I didn't even know that until recently. Yeah. But that's how widespread this problem is. It's just unbelievable. the things that we hear and the things that people go through and survive it. It's just...
I know that from the people I tell, that's like the most inspiring conversations I've had in the last year was talking with people who are actually making recovery, which my next question is, there's probably not a lot of hard math on that, but I get the sense there's a pretty good success rate, at least as far as what you've seen so far. Is that...
Right now we have 32 patients in the program. Eight of those patients have been in recovery longer than a year.
Okay.
12 as of yesterday have been in recovery longer than 90 days.
Okay.
So yes, it does work. We have, you know, new patients that begin with us all the time, and it absolutely does work. The success rate depends on the readiness of the patient, but if the people are willing to follow the rules and, you know, the guidelines and come in when we ask them to come in, it absolutely works.
So going back to the ACEs study, they say one of the critical things in helping someone overcome that is a positive relationship, right, with at least one.
Right.
And I've seen you give pep talks and everything else, Lois. It's really cool.
Sometimes the staff is all the humanity that the patient has left. They don't look at themselves as human. The society doesn't look at them that way, and we're all that they have. And when they come to us, they're just lost, and they think, you know, this is it. I'm without this program, I'm going to die. And we're all that they have sometimes. Their moms don't speak to them. Their kids don't speak to them. They've lost their children or whatever. And sometimes we have to literally wrap our arms around them and just hold on to them for a little while because they feel like they are lost. That quickly starts getting repaired. They make connections with the other patients they're in group with. The patients that have been there for a while take the new patients in. They immediately start exchanging phone numbers. They come in to us lost, and they leave there with a whole group of friends the very first day. So that's a pretty amazing thing to witness.
So I'm going to shift like a little bit to some of the kind of systemic things. You know, first of all, what do you think Governor Justice needs to know? What do the legislative leaders need to know? What does DHHR need to know about this?
First of all, you need to train the clinic staff that these are the most vulnerable patients that you will ever have. And you need to let from the front desk to the back office know that these are the most grateful, the most genuine people that you'll ever come in contact with, the most appreciative. They quickly become your family. These people don't have this disease or disorder because they are morally deficit. This is a disease of their brain, but recovery can happen. Mm-hmm. But it's going to take a lot of training and a lot more ability to treat more people. We need the opportunity to be able to treat more people.
That leads right into my next thing. I know Medicaid expansion has been a lifeline. Governor Tomlin made the decision to do it back in 2013. DHHR at the time did an amazing job of signing people up. I know a lot of your patients come that way. And in the last year, that's been under threat with talk about repealing the whole Affordable Care Act. And now I think our own DHHR, I don't know why I was thinking about a waiver. The feds are wanting waivers, which are some cynical people such as myself see as a way of cutting people off so they can pay for tax cuts for the rich. But far be it from me to use this program as a soapbox because I'm way beyond that point. So, and another thing I heard, something to worry about with Medicaid, there's a cliff effect. So someone gets their life together, they're working, they get a job, Medicaid covers up to 138% of poverty, they get a little raise and thoing. So could you?
We encourage the folks once they get well into recovery to get a job, to be productive, to do the things that, you know, society expects them to do. And that they do that and become successful in their jobs and they get raises, they lose their Medicaid coverage. So now we have a person who has been in recovery for 600 days that's uninsured. And they're terrified. What happens to me now? I lose my ability to come here to get support. I lose my medication. What happens to me now? And we're seeing that happen. And it's scary for us to look at them and say, we're going to help you the best way we know how and the best way we can. We're not going to turn you away. We'll find some way to help you.
Right.
But they are terrified. They're scared to death.
I remember talking like last year to people who are afraid of just if they repealed it. Like people say, I will die if I lose this
coverage. Absolutely will die.
I will lose my kids, you know, and these are people who've seen overdoses and all kind of things. So.
Right.
Yeah.
They will die, certainly. Could I say something else too about the insurance situation?
Sure.
When people get jobs, and even if they have available to them commercial insurance at their jobs, mm-hmm. a lot of times those plans don't cover addiction therapy.
Right.
So then they're caught in that. If they opt for that employer provided insurance, they're still not covered for their addiction and the therapy that goes with that, or and the medication. So they're looking at paying a lot of money out of pocket just to stay in treatment.
Yeah.
So even if they opt for that insurance, they're still without treatment.
Yeah, and
so
it's a real fragile state.
It is very fragile.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, can you think of anything else that you think people need to know or you'd like to say as before we wrap this up?
If other community health centers opt to do this, or other FQHCs want to do this, they should. Miracles happen. And to be a witness to this, to see these people grow and become well and change, is absolute miracle. I could talk for hours about the good things that I see. We don't often hear about the good. You know, we hear this many people overdosed and first responders are overwhelmed, which that's all true.
Right.
But we don't often see the faces of recovery. And I have 30 people in a program that are in recovery, and to see that happen is miraculous. And I'm very, very proud to be a part of that.
You should be.
I wish we could have 300.
So sometimes on this program, Scott asks me for a Bible verse. I'm not going to go there, but I do think about the prodigal son story, you know, from the Gospel of Luke, where, you know, the son come back and the older brother's like, you know, this guy's a freeloader bum. Why are you giving him help?
Right.
And the father says, you know, it's like someone coming back from the dead.
Well, it's odd that you should say that. I have a grandfather of a patient say that, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. We should just let these people do whatever happens to them, happens to them. And I said, you know better than that. Your dad was a minister. The heroin addicts of today were biblical times lepers.
Yeah.
It's up to us to take care of them. We are responsible for these people. We have to stop looking down on them. They're our brothers and our sisters and our children and our mothers and fathers. And this is humanity. Mm-hmm. We don't just cast them away because there's a problem. It's our responsibility as human beings to take care of them. And that's what we fully intend to do.
Well, thanks for being here, and thanks for your hard work on this. Our guest, Lois Vance, Cabin Creek Health Systems Care Coordinator for working with people who are in recovery. And that's the Front Porch for this week. Thanks, everybody.